This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. The House of Representatives returns to legislating this week. The House took a self-imposed time out after the shooting rampage in Tucson, in which 6 were killed and 13 injured, among them Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. First on the agenda is one of the most divisive bills of the session, a measure to repeal last year's health care overhaul. It's unclear how much the tenor of the debate will change in the aftermath of the shootings. One thing that is clear, as NPR's Julie Rovner reports, is that Democrats, now playing defense on the health law, are finally coalescing around a single message.
For Republicans, the message about the new health care law has been simple. It's bad. Here's House Speaker John Boehner at a news conference.
It will ruin the best health care system in the world. It'll bankrupt our nation, and it will ruin our economy.
And here's House Rules Committee Chairman David Dreyer.
The words reckless and unsustainable hardly begin to cover it. This bill is an economic and fiscal disaster of unprecedented proportions.
In fact, the bill they'll vote on this week is called the Repealing the Job-Killing Health Care Law Act. Democrats, on the other hand, have had a much more difficult job selling the merits of the law. They've had to explain why the bill is good and what's actually in it. That's led lawmakers to resort to reciting lengthy laundry lists of provisions. Those have often done more to confuse than to enthuse the public. George Lakoff is a linguistics professor at the University of California at Berkeley. He says President Obama missed a big opportunity during the height of the debate. After a month of controversial town hall meetings around the country, the president gave a nationally televised speech to try to reframe the health care bill. But Lakoff says instead of casting the effort as a moral imperative,
he gave a speech on 24 points of policy.
And that's the big difference between the two parties when it comes to messaging.
The conservatives create moral messages. The Democrats create policy messages, and policy messages either go over people's heads or bore them.
Lakoff says he doesn't think Democrats are doing much better these days, but Bob Crittenden disagrees. Crittenden runs the Herndon Alliance, which has helped shape the message for dozens of groups that support the health law.
There's a lot of interest in being very focused and disciplined about how we're going to talk to the American people.
Crittenden helped write a series of recommendations last summer to help backers of the law sell it to the public. A key one was to make it less complicated.
Put the provisions of the health care bill into personal terms through stories and real things where how it really affects people.
And it seems like lawmakers are taking that advice. For example, Florida Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz has taken to telling this story about one grateful constituent.
Recently, I was in the grocery store, and a woman came up to me and literally put her hands on my shoulders and said, "Debbie, thank you. Thank you for passing health care reform. You saved me $3,000 last year when I was able to put my two adult daughters back on my insurance plan."
Crittenden's group said backers of the law should also focus on parts of the law that have already gone into effect. That includes things like letting young adults get back on their parents' health plans, giving seniors bigger discounts on prescription drugs, and giving small businesses tax credits if they offer health insurance to their workers.
They're a very small part of the bill, but crucial, and also the American people love those things.
Lawmakers seem to be taking that advice, too. Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey highlighted what would happen to seniors' new drug benefits if Republicans succeed in repealing the law.
GOP used to stand for Grand Old Party. Now it stands for Grandma's Out of Prescriptions.
The Republican repeal bill is expected to pass the House easily but die in the Senate. Meanwhile, the messaging battle is likely to continue unabated. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. More than 14 million people in the U.S. are currently out of work. Economists say it will be years before most Americans who want a job can find one. In terms of the labor market and the unemployment rate, St. Louis, Missouri looks much like the nation as a whole. And over the next year, here on All Things Considered, we'll be following 6 people who live in the greater St. Louis area. All are unemployed, and all are searching for work. Today, NPR's Tamara Keith takes us to St. Louis and begins our year-long portrait of the unemployed.
Until March, Cassandra Bronner worked for one of the largest employers in St. Louis, certainly the most famous, Anheuser-Busch. Bronner had been there 11 years, working her way up to a marketing manager job.
My last position, I really enjoyed it, and it was kind of a like a rug taken from under me.
Bronner was among hundreds the company laid off. She never thought it would take this long to find work, and the search is clearly wearing on her, both financially and emotionally. Bronner is 39, a single mother with two daughters in elementary school.
It's difficult because I'm what they have. You know, it's, well, you bought us that stuff before. How come we can't do it now?
For Bronner and the five others will follow over the coming year, there is one central goal.
I just want to work.
I'll do what I have to do.
Right now, I will take any job.
We will do what it takes. It's just, I can't find that place yet.
I will take it just to get work.
That last voice was Jennifer Barfield. She's an IT professional and was laid off from her longtime job at a law firm back in March of 2009.
It's hard to not be depressed. I don't know who couldn't be depressed if they were going through this.
Barfield is 47 years old and a newlywed.
My name is Brian Barfield. I've had my share of down bad times. But having met Jen, it's starting to come around and look up, and it'll be fine.
They met at the GO Network, a group for unemployed people in St. Louis. Then, last January, Brian proposed spontaneously.
We were having dinner downtown, and the lights were low, and she looked beautiful sitting there, and I just knew I was ready, and so I said, will you marry me?
Now they're in this together. Brian is 53 and spent his career in manufacturing. He worked for Chrysler and one of its suppliers until the carmaker shut down its operations in the St. Louis area. For most of the last year, he had another job managing a warehouse. Then in October, right after a honeymoon spent at home to save money, he lost that job too.
Really, if just one of us could get a job, we could live a decent life until the other did. It's really frustrating to me that both of us don't have it.
At this point, they're getting by on unemployment benefits and money pulled from Jennifer's 401k. But her benefits will run out soon. The clock is ticking on Randy Howland's benefits, too.
This is my calendar. You can see I probably have two interviews a week and maybe two others that are phone interviews or follow-ups, phone calls. And then I do networking.
Howland is 50 years old and has been out of work for more than a year.
Yes, I'm one of those people that's been on unemployment for a long, long time.
In that time, he's applied for more than 600 jobs. 600. He's quite tech savvy and programmed his computer to fill in most of the blanks on the applications for him. The jobs are mostly in customer service and sales, offering low wages. Howland has a master's degree in telecommunications and peaked at a six-figure salary back in 2002. The problem is, the telecom industry as he knew it doesn't exist anymore.
I've had people look at my resume that said, hey, no, you got to remove that. That's technology from the, 20s or something. It makes me look out of touch.
Hi, big boy. Hi. What are you doing?
Annika Trotter is talking to her infant son, Gregory. He's smiley and alert. Trotter lost her job in October, shortly after her son was born. She had been working for a social services agency, helping people with disabilities find jobs. Now she's applying those skills to her own job search, networking and checking with friends and family.
But right now it just doesn't seem like there's anything available.
Trotter is 25, has two children, and the kind of drive you wouldn't want to bet against. In addition to her job search, she's starting a baking business.
Cakes and cupcakes are the main things. Muffins, quiches, pot pies, pound cakes.
She's calling it the Bright Oven.
Instead of just waiting for someone to decide that they wanted to be my boss, I could kind of start to be my own boss. And I think that once I get a job, I know that I'll be able to do both.
She's sure she'll land a new job in 3 months or less. That's what 54-year-old Ray Meyer thought, too. But he's been searching for work for more than 2 years, so long that he's run out of unemployment benefits.
I've done some small jobs for neighbors and some friends as far as landscaping and painting and some physical labor kind of things, you know, to make ends meet.
This after a 30-year career in banking. In his last job, Meyer was a regional manager. But then, like so many small banks, the one he was working for ran into financial trouble. Since then, he's been on 25 job interviews, but none of them panned out. Still, he says every time it felt so good to put on his banker's clothes again.
When I have my shiny little shoes on and I'm ready to go to for an interview, I feel like I'm on top of the world. I really do. And it's sad.
His wife still has her job. She's a teacher. Meyer gets up early every morning to pack her lunch. He does most of the housework now, just to keep himself busy between submitting resumes and following up on leads.
It wears on you. It really does.
We'll hear more from Ray, Brian, Jennifer, Randy, Cassandra, and Annika in the weeks and months to come as they search for jobs and hopefully find them. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Sources for this project were identified with help from the Public Insight Network of American Public Media, the Nine Network of Public Media, the St. Louis Beacon, and St. Louis Public Radio. We've all been there. You're at a restaurant, you've finished your meal, and you really want to pay your check and leave, but the waiter is nowhere to be found. Well, a new service allows you to speed things up by text. From member station WBUR, Jessica Alpert reports.
It's a Thursday night when I walk into Charlie's Kitchen, a dive bar and cafe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Charlie's is one of the first restaurants in the country to try Text My Food, a new service that allows you to communicate with your server via text. I slip into a corner booth and see a sticker on the wall. Can't find your server? Just text.
I'm at table 3. I want a tossed salad with ranch dressing. That's a lot of typing. Send.
In less than 5 minutes, my meal has arrived. Charlie's server, Christina Henry, watches me navigate the system.
You know, there's pros and cons to it. You know, it's great for like a night, like Friday night when we're really busy. It's packed and you're running around. People text like, can I have my check, please?
While Christina acknowledges that Text My Food may make her job easier, she finds the service impersonal.
As a server, I'd rather go to the guest and talk to them face to face and ask them what they would like instead of getting it through a computer.
When I visit Bob Nilsson, the president of Text My Food, he makes it clear that the service doesn't actually replace the server.
It's not eliminating human contact. There's always a server at the other end. You just want to have that contact sooner. You want to, if you can't see them and can't make that contact, rather than waving your arms or getting up, just use the natural communication and let them know what you need.
Nilsson explains that the goal of the service is to increase the amount a guest will spend. For example, guests are more likely to order another round of drinks if they text the request in the moment. If they can't find the server, they often pass. Back in the dining room, customer Zach Brickett is not impressed.
I guess it seems kind of pointless because I can tell my waitress to her face what I want to drink, so.
But John McSweeney has a different view. While he calls the system interesting,
I wondered that there's going to be a lot of abuse of this kind of thing. It sort of occurred to me to maybe just as soon as we ordered our beers, take out my phone and be like, beer, stat, now.
I've gotten glasses are sexy. I've gotten two of us need something. And three of us need your number.
That's Charlie's server, Joshua DeCosta. Prank texting is a problem. In response, some heavy drinking establishments turn off the service after a certain hour. But other managers say they appreciate the ability to monitor guests. If too many inappropriate texts come in from one person, It's time to cut them off. So I'm sitting with my check and credit card ready to pay. It's been a while, so instead of waving, I decide to send a little text.
Okay, T3, my credit card is waiting. Send.
A few seconds later, the server comes over, produces a smile, grabs my credit card, and heads back into the kitchen. We've barely exchanged a word, but I find texting extremely alluring. I message, she arrives. But don't worry, I left her an in-person tip. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Alpert.
All Things Considered continues right after this. The CEO of Apple, Steve Jobs, said today that he's taking another leave of absence from the company for medical reasons, though he did not provide any further details about his health. In recent years, Jobs has survived pancreatic cancer and underwent a liver transplant. As NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, the announcement is raising fresh questions about the fate of the company Steve Jobs founded.
Jobs made his announcement in a six-sentence email to his staff this morning. He said he loved Apple so much and hoped to be back as soon as possible, but he didn't say when that might be. In the meantime, the company will be headed by Chief Operating Officer Tim Cook, who performed the same function during one of Jobs' previous leaves. But Steve Jobs says he will still weigh in on major strategic decisions. James McQuivey is an analyst at Forrester Research.
He is the soul and energy of the company. And so it's very, very hard to imagine that this time out, if he's away, he's still not going to be receiving phone calls and guiding the company in his absence.
In his email, Jobs asked people to respect his privacy, but that's unlikely to stop speculation about his condition and the company's future. Jobs is a central figure at Apple who has presided over the creation of hugely successful products like the iPod and the iPhone. The last time he took a leave, the company's stock price plummeted, though it later recovered. U.S. financial markets were closed today for the holiday, but in Frankfurt, where Apple shares are also sold, they fell more than 8%. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. In schools around the country, the size of classes is growing. Half the districts responding to a recent poll say they're increasing class size because of budget pressures. Many schools fear this will hurt students. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, some education reformers say it doesn't have to.
Marguerite Rosa analyzes school spending for the Gates Foundation. She's been watching districts deal with tight budgets through across-the-board cuts and other desperation moves. Rosa believes schools don't have to view tight spending limits as a lose-lose proposition.
The idea that money has no flexibility, I think, prevents district leaders from making some choices earlier on that would help them in the long run.
Rosa is pushing for adoption of a number of efficiency measures that would help schools even when fatter budgets return. One suggestion is to create a rigorous teacher evaluation system so that schools will know which teachers are most effective. One big benefit, says Rosa, is that would allow districts to increase the size of some classes.
If there's a trade-off between higher teacher quality or smaller class sizes, then we are better off going with higher teacher quality.
Now, research on class size is complicated. There's evidence that smaller classes can help learning, but only if you bring the numbers down below, say, 17 students. That's a number most districts can only dream of. When you already have 25 or 30 kids in a class, there's reason to believe that small increases might not matter. Michelle Rhee is former chancellor of schools for the District of Columbia, and she now heads the advocacy group Students First. She also says that with the right preparation, bigger classes can be an effective way to save money.
The way that I think would make sense is to identify the most highly effective teachers in a particular district and think about assigning a few more students to each of their classrooms.
But representatives for teachers groups say this is all a smokescreen.
If somebody says, I want to raise class size, they're doing it to cut the budget, not because it's actually going to help children.
Randy Weingarten is head of the American Federation of Teachers. Many teachers say it's common sense. Larger classes mean students get less one-on-one attention and teachers have more work. And Weingarten says plenty of parents agree.
Teachers and parents will tell you that the reason they want smaller class sizes is so that they can differentiate instruction.
To deal with the fact that some kids need special help because of learning problems or language differences. Some schools are experimenting with other ways to reduce personnel costs without necessarily raising class sizes. Rocket Ship Education has three charter schools in California. Founder John Danner says his schools save money by putting even the youngest kids into a learning lab for one period a day. There, they get carefully guided computer-based instruction and are supervised by a teacher's aide.
You only need three kindergarten teachers instead of four, because the fourth one's in learning lab, so you don't need a teacher for them.
Danner says part of the savings goes into extensive career development for teachers so they can be more effective. Bigger class sizes can be a hard sell to parents, but some education reformers say parents may embrace this idea as preferable to cutting art classes or raising fees. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
We have more recommendations now from our Three Books series. Today, Gish Jen offers her prescription for those of us feeling exhausted by the noise and clutter of high-tech life.
Are you sick of the world of endless information? Are facts and factoids adding up to less and less truth every day? Perhaps it is time for something fabulous, by which I mean not something great to wear to your next party, but something fable-like in its imaginative insight into the human condition. For example, how about Michael Kohlhaas by Heinrich von Kleist? This gripping 19th century novella about a German man whose horses have been unjustly maltreated feels thrillingly modern as an ordinary, stubborn man demands justice from a system stacked against him. Greatly beloved of Kafka, who viewed the story, he said, with true reverence, Michael Kohlhaas speaks not only of the implacability of power, but also the mania of heroism and, as the aggrieved man raises an army against his oppressors, the morality of insurrection. Is the protagonist a holy man or a terrorist? To read this book is to think hard about figures from John Brown to Julian Assange. Equally rewarding is Waiting for the Barbarians by J.M. Coetzee. This haunting love story involves the plump magistrate of a town at the edge of an empire braced for invasion. Standing helplessly by as empire officials torture the so-called barbarians, the magistrate takes in a blinded and crippled barbarian girl, not for sexual gratification, as you might guess, but for something yet deeper, as ritualistically and confusedly he tends to her wounds, washing her and rubbing her with oil. You could certainly read this as a parable about guilt and complicity in the apartheid South Africa in which Coetzee was writing, and it is. But Waiting for the Barbarians is more than that. Rich with portraits of cruelty, fear, tenderness, and turmoil, the novel asks some profoundly troubling questions. What will become of us without barbarians, for example? An excellent question in an anti-immigrant age, and who are the barbarians exactly? And finally, for a change of pace, I recommend Mark Twain's effervescent Diary of Adam and Eve. If ever you have wondered about the human capacity to make things anew, wonder no more. In recasting the story of the Garden of Eden with unfailing wit and delicious bravado, Twain does more than entertain. He testifies to the great human ability to reinvent, reconceive, and reanimate even the most graven of narratives. This new creature with long hair is a good deal in the way, begins this book. Adam and Eve, in this telling, do not exactly seem a match made in heaven. And yet years later, by her graveside, Adam comes movingly to write, "Wheresoever she was, there was Eden." Love and laughter spring eternal, it seems. And if you think that the economy will never pick up and that we are looking at the end of Western civilization as we know it, well, not to forget. We have been through a fall before. And what's more, we have lived to tell the tale.
Gish Jen's latest novel is called World and Town. You can read more 3 Books recommendations at npr.org/books.